You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of November 2017 on Monocle 24. Welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Christopher Lord. On today's show, the Paradise Papers. Why are some of the world's most wealthy figures, including royalty, politicians and Bono, complicit in less than salubrious business practices?
Because you're good at philanthropy, I think, is the thing. And because I'm an activist, people think you should be stupid in business. I don't run with that.
My guests, Joy Lodico and John Everard, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the latest gun massacre in the US. We'll ask why leaders still are not addressing the problem.
But this isn't a guns situation. I mean, we could go into it, but it's a little bit soon to go into it. But fortunately, somebody else had a gun that was shooting in the opposite direction. Otherwise, it would have been as bad as it was. It would have been much worse.
Plus, we'll be looking at a dramatic 48 hours in Saudi politics. And elsewhere, we'll ask whether Theresa May can convince the UK's business leaders that Brexit is in any way a good idea. All to come here on Midori House with me, Christopher Lord. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Joy Lodico, columnist for London's Evening Standard, and John Everard, the former British ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay and North Korea. Welcome both of you to the programme. The murky financial dealings of some of the world's elite figures, ranging from royalty to politicians and rock stars, have come to light in the past 24 hours. The Paradise Papers, so-called due to the tropical locations of many of the offshore low-tax havens scrutinised in the leak, consist of 13.4 million documents obtained by the German newspaper Süddeutsche Zeitung. This leak was then, of course, shared with other media partners around the world via the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Joy, let's start with you. All day, we've seen revelations of the various celebrities and politicians who've benefited from these offshore low-tax havens, not least the investment arm, of course, of Queen Elizabeth II. But by focusing on these perpetrators in the news and in the media, are we kind of not getting to the source here? There's legislation and there is a culture that allows this to flourish, isn't there?
Well, I actually think if you're focusing on these celebrities, it's likely to make the story more exciting than it actually is. This is essentially a set of documents. This is not that dissimilar from the Panama Papers. There's some new names in it, some new trails to follow. In terms of the legislation, there's already been a huge movement to try and stop or to try to open up offshore financial centres to scrutiny. 2013, 90 countries signed up to allow various tax authorities, their own tax authorities, to go and investigate people. The problem is, there's a question of how far you can legislate, because they are there for a reason. They've been there historically. They are used for completely neutral purposes, which will be, you know, transfers of money and so forth. But the problem I think we have is because they are essentially used for secrecy, we as journalists can't go looking into them. Lawyers have a hell of a trouble trying to find people through when they've got money in tax havens. And the tax authorities, Lord love them, really just don't have time to go chasing after everybody. I mean, one of the names on that list is Lord Ashcroft, who's a big party political donor. He's been in the newspapers with questions about his tax affairs for decades and decades and decades. And suddenly we find that he's got 450 million offshore that hasn't been raised before. I mean, it's actually quite extraordinary.
John, just respond to that idea. I mean, have we learned anything here that will change? You know, as Joy's saying, we've known this since the Panama Papers, and we've known this from before. These tax havens, of course, exist. Does the Paradise Papers now actually reveal anything that will change policy, that will change legislation and bring some of these offshore havens into some sort of, you know, into some greater relationship with their tax, with countries in Europe and so on?
I think over time, yes. I doubt if this is the last of these revelations. Remember the shock that came out at the time of the Panama Papers, where people realised to just what lengths the global elite were prepared to go to shelter their tax. I think the Paradise Papers, the ones that came out over the weekend, will add to impetus to that. They will add to the outrage that many, many people feel when they see that, well, they work reasonably hard and even occasionally pay their taxes, that those who have got vastly more money than they do are simply avoiding doing so. And of course, you know, this causes real anger. I mean, Joy's quite right. Legally, the whole problem is really very difficult. Politically, it is brutally straightforward. This is completely unacceptable, and a way will eventually be found to crack down on these places, simply because, you know, as things go on, people will simply refuse to stand for further such evasions. One important point. We're only a few hours into these revelations. 13.8, I think you said, million documents. Some vast number. They've got 300 and something journalists who've been working on this for a bit. They cannot possibly have got through even a small fraction of what has been released. We are going to be drip-fed information from these papers for a long time to come.
Yes, but
I'm sure there's some big names in there.
I would argue as a journalist, though, that the front, you know, the first day of this, which has taken 8 months' worth of investigation, has produced the fascinating, perhaps, statistic that the Queen has £3,000 invested in a retail high street sort of slightly a place called Bright House that slightly takes advantage of poor people.
No, that she of course claims that she's not directly aware
she's
of
not
what
directly
this investment
aware. I'm afraid as a journalist I don't think that's actually a huge scoop. I think the Wilbur Ross revelation is fascinating.
And I would say argue the social media revelations
social
are probably
media,
even more fascinating.
Twitter and Facebook are fascinating. Yeah. But if this is the first day, I don't see anything particularly, you know, game-changing in Bono and, you know, the stars of, you know, British comedies, Irish comedies, in fact, you know, putting their money in offshore tax havens. And I also don't think, because of the change in legislation in 2013, that you are necessarily talking about lots of people being anything more than tax efficient rather than tax avoidant.
John, just picking up one.
Is that a real distinction? I mean, the tax efficiency is, by definition, tax avoidance within the law.
Well, I wrote a little item in my column today saying, well, the one thing I don't do is go crawling through my pension fund, which is administered by the company, to go and check where they're putting their money. It's perfectly possible that every single one of us has got a little bit of paradise in that our pensions are in some way in an offshore island, or we've got an investment in a business that's located out there.
Joe, I'm sure you're right, but not with Appleby. I mean, Appleby are the Rolls Royce. You only go to Appleby if you are seriously rich and if you are going to go to really quite considerable lengths to shelter your money from taxation. This isn't really about the pension funds of people like you and me. This is about very rich people who are trying very hard to avoid tax.
Joy, just coming away from the actual tax element here, I mean, let's talk a bit about Wilbur Ross, which you raised before. I mean, this is Donald Trump's Commerce Secretary, and this Paradise Papers have revealed that he is a shareholder in a company that has ties to Vladimir Putin's son-in-law. Now, with this ongoing Russian collusion investigation happening in the US, I mean, you couldn't really write this, could you?
No, I think that one's a fascinating one. He will have been through an ethics committee process, and he won't have had to declare this particular money in a shipping firm called Navigator because it wasn't in the rules. It raises an ethical question as to whether you should be making money out of a Russian company so closely tied to Putin at a point at which relations are so difficult. And I think he doesn't deny it. It's not like the Queen saying, I'm terribly sorry, I hadn't got a clue, it was through an investment fund. He's heavily involved in it. The other interesting thing that came up, which is in relation to Navigation, is the other firm he's got an investment in shipping, does shipping mainly, I think it's called Diamond S, does mainly shipping to China. Now, this is the US Commerce Secretary, and he's invested in two shipping routes, Russia and China, which would rather suggest that he thinks those are places where there's going to be a lot of trade going on.
I mean, we have to remember Wilbur Ross, of course, when he joined the cabinet, was scrutinised a lot for the fact that, you know, he's done business in China for years. He has one of the most famous Chinese art collections in the US. I mean, he's somebody there. But I do think that you're right. It reveals the extent of interest that he has that sometimes seem to jar with the business of the administration, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, I think he's truly international in not necessarily the sort of most salubrious way. I mean, he was also previously vice chairman of the Bank of Cyprus, which is a favourite of Russian investors. And again, you won't be able to go through those bank accounts. You won't be able to find out what money has gone through them without some very serious investigative journalism. But I would imagine that were those records released, they would be far more juicy than
what we've seen this weekend. John, just very briefly before we move on, I want to ask you, as we talked about before, Facebook and Twitter, these papers have revealed that Russian state institutions, albeit in a fairly circuitous way, some money from them has gone into investments in both of these platforms. Isn't it about time that there's some responsibility taken on both of these? I mean, we're seeing this whole question in the US at the moment about Russian-funded ads and so on. Are Twitter and Facebook really revealing and being as transparent as they should be?
Well, we don't know, because we don't know how transparent, you know, what it is that we don't know, is what I mean. There must be a strong presumption in the light of this information that there are real questions to answer there. If they had these investments, how far did this give them influence over the policies of these platforms? How far did this facilitate the gross misuse of the platforms that Mueller's investigation is turning up, and so on? I suspect it'll be a while before we get solid answers to these questions, but they are important.
We'll have to see with those 13.4 million documents what else comes out of there. Now, staying in the US, the United States is once again mourning another mass shooting on its soil. 26 people were killed yesterday after a gunman armed with what witnesses say was a semi-automatic weapon opened fire at a Baptist church in Sutherland Springs, Texas. President Donald Trump has addressed the atrocity from Japan, where he's on an Asian tour. Trump said this isn't a guns situation and blamed the tragedy on the shooter's mental health instead. Joy, is that significant that he's blamed it on mental health? I mean, if we think to the attack recently in New York, he said that the attacker then was deranged. Is this a change of narrative, do you think?
Well, the attacker in New York, obviously, it was deemed to be a terrorist attack at the time. This is another domestic attack. It's a white man who seemed to be having a row with his mother-in-law. That seems to be the reason behind it.
But I mean, that sort of that connection between what happened previously, you know, Trump said this is a deranged individual when the New York attacker, when that attack happened. And he's used similar language again here, hasn't he?
Well, he has used similar language again. It doesn't take on the broader issue of why a deranged individual has access to a gun. And, you know, locating in mental health again moves it away from the big issue, which is why anybody who has got a mental health problem has access to a gun at all. And why does the general population have such easy access to guns? There was a curiosity in this, which in fact the killer had in fact been turned down for a gun license, which hasn't been mentioned in any of the previous cases. Everybody else had managed to get them. So somewhere in the Texas authorities, a flag had been raised, but not far enough.
John, what do you think about this statement that Trump made? This isn't a gun situation.
It's another sickening defence of the indefensible. I mean, quite clearly, this affair is all about easy access to guns. Yes, of course, he would not have pulled that trigger had he not had issues of some kind. We may never get to the bottom exactly what was driving him. But if he had not been able to acquire a semi-automatic weapon, for heaven's sake, I mean, there's no way that he could have killed all those people. Joy has pointed out that he was denied a gun license at some point in the past. Under federal law, if you are dishonorably discharged from the armed forces, you are banned from holding a gun. Somebody somewhere goofed. He should never have been sold those guns. So there's a question of implementation as well as policy here. It all went very badly wrong.
Joy, any thoughts on that one? I mean, you know, this idea that there was simply, you know, there's a mistake made in the past. I mean, will this be used as a defence, do you think, by the gun lobbies, who will say, well, this was a one-off incident, a mistake that was made previously in the past when he was given a gun and he shouldn't have been. Actually, this doesn't affect fundamental ownership.
Have we established that he was given a gun when he should have been? It shouldn't have been. I'm not sure that is the case. I think he was denied a gun and has still got hold of one. I don't think we know the source of the gun.
You mean he may not have been sold it? He may have acquired it.
He may have acquired it. Everybody's got a gun. You've just got to go, you know, round to your neighbour and borrow your neighbour's gun in the States. I mean, it's quite normal to find them, you know,
chilling,
in shops.
True.
I'm not sure that's necessarily a mistake. I think it begins to put the NRA under a little bit more pressure. I mean, we've now had a series of attacks, Las Vegas obviously being the most serious recently, to explain how they can continue to justify widespread gun ownership and yet still refuse to have any sort of controls. There has been an attempt at control here, but it's clearly not enough to exclude certain people from ownership.
John, I mean, you know, I feel like this conversation happens every time one of these happens, but what will it take for the NRA to start to look at these policies that what Joy's talking about?
for the NRA to start looking at these policies, I think we're looking at the four horsemen of the apocalypse, to be honest. For the American public at large to force a meaningful debate on this and to push for greater restrictions on gun ownership, very difficult to say. I mean, every time we get these massacres, people say this must be a tipping point, but life just goes on. It's as if America's inured to these things.
Well, I locate it with the NRA because politically, Donald Trump is not going to do anything about gun ownership. In a sense, it has to be the gun lobby, the people who actually look after those gun owners, who defend their rights time after time after time, who at this point have to, at some point, enter this argument and, you know, enter the narrative of what's going on and say, well, things do have to change. Trump has made it absolutely clear he believes that you know, Americans have the right to bear weapons. Indeed, he's, you know, rapidly rearming the United States as we speak. So it's not, he's not going to do it. Somebody has to take some responsibility.
Yes, I agree. Not only is Trump doing it, but we see that the governor of Texas a couple of years ago called for Texans to be more proactive in going out and buying guns, which is a kind of a view of life which I find difficult to get my head around. Of course, there's must be a terrible moral onus on the NRA to face up to the implications of what does they stand for. But they didn't really step up to the plate after Las Vegas, and I would love to think that they will this time, but I'm frankly not holding my breath.
No, I do doubt it, but I do think that's where the change has to start. I mean, it's so totemic, this idea of gun ownership in the United States. In fact, it's very difficult to translate it even to, you know, we're all in the studio looking a little bit baffled yet again about the idea that, you know, one's neighbour has a gun. It's got a sort of religious value to it in the way that, you know, for Brits, for certain Brits, a very different social group, believe deeply in the NHS. I don't know how a society begins to try and unpick those set of values to, you know, begin to look at them through a lens. And I know it's in the Constitution. However, you know, many things are in the Bible that have been reinterpreted over the course of history.
John, I just wonder, obviously Trump is in Asia right now as this is all unfolding. And I wonder, you know, you're a diplomat, you know, you during your career, you worked a lot in that region. How will this go down with his hosts this week? I mean, if you think about the image of the US at the moment, this is again another image of a mass shooting on its soil. Does it chip away at its sort of at its viability as a partner still? I mean, is it, you know, does this have grander political implications for Trump this week, do you think?
I'm not sure that it chips away at the viability of the US as a partner. It certainly chips away at the US's image. I mean, clearly, countries where people open up with automatic weapons on church congregations have got problems. This kind of thing just doesn't happen in Japan. Okay, it happens in China, but I mean, it doesn't get reported in quite the same way. But of course, all this feeds into the gross imbalance now between Trump and his hosts. Trump enmeshed in very difficult political scandals. He's yet to see the full force of the Mueller inquiry. He's failed to deliver on the great majority of his campaign promises. His ratings are slipping. Sitting there with Abe, who's just won a thumping great election victory against all the predictions by the pundits, and is busy mapping out a very clear vision for the future of Japan, and about to go to see Xi Jinping, who of course is now riding high, having settled himself up as effectively the supreme leader of China, unassailable politically and ideologically, whereas Trump is in deep trouble.
Joy, just not to go too far from this shooting that's happened, but I wonder with this trip that's coming up now for Trump across Asia, as John mentioned, across China, Vietnam and so on, can he win friends here, do you think?
In China?
Oh, well, across Asia. I mean, if you look across that region, will this be a success for Trump, do you think?
It's interesting. I was listening to Wilbur Ross talking the other day at a meeting, and he seemed to think that in the next few days, he and Trump and China are going to be announcing some very big, you know, deals, that they're going to basically say, we are going to be working together on various things. I'm not entirely sure how the Chinese react to somebody who's been so hostile in the trade wars and then turns up and, you know, shakes hands and slaps backs. I would imagine they're a much more sophisticated nation than that, pretty clever, and growing at a much faster rate than the US. And so the question is, you know, how much of a deal do they actually want to do with the US at the moment?
I'll have to see.
I think the fact that they launched a special island-creating vessel just the day before Trump started his visit indicates what kind of mood they're in.
Are you listening to Midori House with me, Christopher Lord, Joy Lodico and John Everard? We'll be back in just a moment's time and we'll check in with Saudi Arabia.
For November, Monocle heads into the season of mists and mellow fruitfulness, boldly going beyond the chocolate box with a big old trip to Switzerland. Uphill and down valley, our team trekked and tobogganed to bring you the extra thick cream of the crop. The cities and villages, designers, chefs, businesses and opportunities that set these fair cantons apart. Elsewhere in the pages, it's business as usual, which means highly unusual. Where else are you going to get a report from Iceland's strategic airbase? A tour bus diary from the Coptic Pope as he plays to packed crowds of believers in Melbourne? A report from the growing independence movement in the Faroe Islands? Or a trip to meet the artists ensuring Jeddah stays Saudi Arabia's most liberal city? Some extra cherries on the cake come in the form of the tour of two halves of the Yves Saint Laurent museums in Paris and Marrakesh, an absolutely gorgeous house in Tasmania that we're all fighting over to stay at, and a whistle-stop tour of the International Baking Renaissance. Now there's a sentence that makes the cake to put the cherry on in the first place. Full circle. Switzerland's wonders never cease. Monocle's November issue is out now.
You're listening to Midori House. I'm Chris Lloyd. Still with me are John Everard and Joy Lodico. It's been a dramatic weekend in Saudi Arabia. Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri announced his resignation from the relative safety of the Saudi capital, Riyadh. Then a missile launched from the Iranian-backed rebels in Yemen and aimed at the Saudi capital was intercepted before it could cause harm. And this wasn't enough. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman launched an anti-corruption drive that saw 11 princes and four ministers placed under arrest. John, we know about this ambitious Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and his various power grabs. Rounding up these royals in a way, you know, somebody who's watched Asia for a long time. Didn't this remind you a little bit of a sort of Xi Jinping style, I'm going to show you who's in charge?
Yes, very much so. I was about to make exactly that analogy. I mean, on a slightly smaller scale, of course, but this is exactly what Xi Jinping has been doing for some time. It's just that Xi Jinping has done it over a period, whereas MBS has decided to do it on one day, bang, which had this kind of an impact that has probably sort of added point to what he was trying to achieve. It was, of course, it's caused a huge intake of breath across Asia. In Saudi Arabia, these things just don't happen. And they certainly don't happen. And then you find that MBS, who's carried this through, has got away with it. Hardly a squeak of opposition to what he's done. And they were all sitting, probably not very happily, but all sitting in a smart hotel in Riyadh. No real attempt to break out. No violence, no protest, no nothing.
Joy, coming to you, I mean, this Crown Prince, he's wanted to give the world the impression that Saudi is changing. You know, he's said that women can drive from June next year. We now see this big so-called anti-corruption drive. Do you buy it?
Well, it's interesting. I thought the most interesting detail which came out from this was that he'd been meeting with Jared Kushner, who's another of these kind of young princes who seems to be shaping the modern world. Do we buy it? I thought the women being allowed to drive seemed such a radical step for a country. I mean, it's such a big issue, the suppression of women in Saudi Arabia, that he clearly had understood that Saudi Arabia has to change to really be part of the modern world, that various things have to shift. He's in his 30s, early 30s?
32.
He's waiting for, he's got, 6 months a year until he's in charge. And he's trying to get rid of a sort of certain entrenched old guard who believe things have to happen a certain way, and they've built up their kind of power base and they've built up their finances over all these decades. Does it mean Saudi Arabia is going to flip into something modern? I mean, I think, you know, you could almost say that you would have thought Bashar al-Assad was about to turn Syria into something modern. You could almost say Saif Gaddafi was going to turn Libya
all these
into something
things
modern.
Do hang in the balance, of course,
I mean, I think that might have been a little bit optimistic.
Absolutely, yeah. John, just coming to you now, I just want to ask you, this is the closest a missile has come to hitting Saudi civilians from Yemen that we've seen so far. Obviously, it's no secret that the Houthis in Yemen are backed by Iran. Will this be viewed as an act of war, do you think, in Riyadh? Do you think this will push along this increasingly tense Cold War we've been seeing lately?
Well, we are already seeing calls in Riyadh for this to be considered an act of war and for Saudi to respond accordingly. I doubt if that view will carry. I don't think that MBS is actually looking for an all-out confrontation with Iran just now. But yes, of course, this adds greatly to the tensions. Iran, always Saudi's bugbear, has proved itself quite willing to sacrifice Saudi civilians in pursuit of its own geopolitical objectives. This won't go down well.
I mean, as always, the country caught up in all this is Lebanon, of course. You know, we've seen now the Prime Minister resign this week, the Sunni Prime Minister, facing, obviously, a growing ascendant Hezbollah in Lebanon. Where does this leave Lebanon, do you think, with the departure of Saad Hariri? Is this going to result in that same political deadlock that it was stuck in for the last few years, you know, when there was no president for a long time? Are we just going to go back to those days where there'll be no budget again when it comes around to that time and Lebanon will go back into stasis?
Yeah, I think this must be the big fear. There's no obvious successor to Hariri. I mean, he went leaving a void. And nor is there a clear mechanism, one that's proved to work, to fill that void. So I think, yes, we are in for a period of instability, of government deadlock, just as, of course, the geopolitical environment in which Lebanon has survived has become that much more complex and that much more hostile. These are not happy times.
Very busy weekend indeed in the Middle East. Finally, to Brexit. The Confederation of British Industry represents over 190,000 businesses in the UK, and today it's been holding its annual conference amid gloomy forecasts as Britain prepares to depart the European Union. UK Prime Minister Theresa May spoke to the Confederation earlier today, where she had to try and rationalise the potential economic cliff jump that Brexit could be. Joy, what does Theresa May have to do to reassure businesses that that the country isn't in trouble?
Well, I think she's in a slightly impossible situation. What she has to do is give businesses a roadmap into the future so that they know what sort of trading relationship we're going to be having with the EU in the distant future, but also the transitional period. She can't do this because the way the talks are structured with the EU is that we have to get to the final arrangement first and then we can talk about the transition. You can't discuss transition until you know what the destination is. Meanwhile, businesses are saying, listen, we really need to know. In fact, they actually need to know now. They're saying, the CBI was rather generously saying, we can wait till March. But, you know, if you're banks and so forth and you're having to face the possibility of moving headquarters, you're already having to buy offices, get the cabling in, get the computers in, and all this is actually very long-term planning.
Yeah, you can't wait until 2019 to start making those choices.
You're making the choices now. Same thing for things like car manufacturers. Why would Nissan want to be building a new car plant for a new line of cars in Sunderland at the moment when it doesn't know whether they're going to meet EU regulations, whether they're going to be tariffs imposed on them? And, you know, they're not planning for 2 years ahead, 3 years ahead. They're planning for, you know, a decade's worth of production.
John, is that helpful, that kind of pressure, do you think, on the government? I mean, they've been pretty sluggish since that referendum started to get down and do some talking about actual business, how it's going to look. Does this kind of pressure that Joy's talking about help, do you think?
I think it probably helps, but I don't think it's enough. I mean, I think the fundamental problem is that the government cannot agree amongst itself what it is that it wants the final deal to look like. And as the European negotiator has said, until the negotiations between the British are concluded, it's hard to talk about serious negotiations with the rest of Europe. And we are getting in the midst of all this quite extraordinary things. I mean, just a few hours ago it emerged that David Davis has refused to release significant elements of the government analysis of the likely impact of Brexit on key business sectors because he says these are not in the public interest. This, of course, is going to cause gasps of astonishment amongst the people sitting in the CBI conference just now. They need to have these analyses. They need to know what's going on. So, as Joy rightly says, they can make their plans.
Theresa May rather laid down a challenge today because what she said is, you are businesses. We operate in a free market. You've essentially voted Conservative for a free market. Why do you keep asking for all this guidance from us? And that was intrinsic in her speech today. And it's a challenge to them. She said, you know, there are all sorts of opportunities. Be optimists. You know, when the moment arises, jump for it. Stop asking for the security blanket of the state.
John, yes. I wonder about these allegations that are going on in the background of all this, of course, around several, you know, if we look at politicians at the moment having several stepping down in recent days. And we've also seen these various allegations come out. How is that playing out on the continent, do you think? I mean, when they're looking to this negotiating partner here in the UK, what sort of conversations are they having in Germany and Brussels about these allegations that are swirling around the cabinet?
OK, so the allegations are about sexual harassment, some of it minor, some of it major, Our defence secretary resigned just a few days ago after it seemed that he'd been inappropriate to the level of harassment with various women. There's another MP who's being investigated by the police. Mm. The problem, which I think Barnier will notice, and indeed all the European leaders will notice, is that they may not be dealing with a stable government in the UK. It only takes seven MPs to resign, to die, to be forced out of office, for there essentially to be no possibility of Theresa May holding this government together. That's it, the government falls. So you can't really afford to have these sexual allegations carrying on. Mm. It looks like they're dying down, but should they ramp up again,
she begins to lose. We'll have to leave it there. That brings us to the end of today's show. John Everard and Joy Lodico, thanks for joining us here at Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall, and we'll be back the same time tomorrow. I'm Chris Lord. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.